Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a massage table here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Lisco.
And with us today is Corinne Steichman.
Past and former, future guest.
Former guest, future guest.
Yes.
Friend of the pod, wonderful human, wanted to do this movie. Thank you for coming on, Corinne. How are you?
I'm so happy.
Happy.
Talking to people. It's nice.
So as our listeners know, we do this over Zoom during the pandemic.
We do.
Corinne has got real close to the screen.
Yeah.
He's trying to make this as intimate as possible, and which is appropriate. This is a very intimate movie, I would say.
Yeah,
it is.
A lot of close-ups.
Uncomfortably, a lot of body parts. Uncomfortably intimate, yeah.
Yes,
I feel like...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should probably talk about massages in general.
Well, this movie starts with a massage, a very intimate. She starts to cry. This movie is very, very earnest. I'd say its curse and its blessing is its earnestness.
Yes.
I went on a journey with this movie with both of you because I texted you both about 10 minutes into the film. And I was like, I don't know, guys, I kind of don't hate this movie. And then by the hour point, I was like, okay, I'm sort of done with this movie. But it starts from a nice place. It has the best of intentions. It's a bit of a snooze.
It starts off like a Hallmark movie. And it's an overworked lady, just got to get to the country, got to meet that guy who plays hockey and is blind and fall in love. And I was like, let's live here. Let's play hockey. But then that's only half an hour.
Yeah, it's. I'll say that maybe one of the most damning things about this film is it's too fucking long. Like this, Corinne and I were texting a little bit about this. Like this is a movie that should have been 90 minutes, like on the nugget. Like it does not need to be 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's just, especially when like it gets quote unquote harrowing for him and he starts having to sort of try to reacclimate to the world around him after he gets his sight back. It just takes too long. It takes too long in that period. And I want to ask you guys this question too. Like there's kind of a moment when he regresses to a childlike understanding of the world around him.
Oh boy. We got to talk about Val Kilmer as a child. Cause that's a thing in this movie.
It's a big thing. It's like 40 minutes of this movie. It feels like,
I would say like, it's 2 hours and 8 minutes of this movie.
Like what's a lobster? I mean, you knew what a lobster was when you were blind, dude. Like, well, you didn't, a lobster didn't change.
I don't agree with you. I strongly disagree with you.
That he's a child or just that he doesn't know what lobster is?
He is a child. He plays... Look, there's so much wrong with this movie. But if you had never seen a lobster before... You would not know what a lobster is, mm-hmm. and you would, and I think you might think people eat this because it's revolting looking. That's not what the big issue is for me. I mean, everything about this movie. And, all right, there are very few movies we've done that I would say constitute a war crime, but this is a war crime.
Oh, okay. Explain.
Well, crime against you, maybe a crime against humanity. I'm not sure. It certainly violates the Geneva Convention. This movie is all right. So I want. There are two things I want to kind of say before to set the stage from what I'm thinking. One is I went into this movie kind of wanting to like it. I think Phil had the same feeling. Corinne, have you seen this movie before?
I saw this film in the theaters in 1999.
Perfect. I'm guessing you did as well.
And
no, I didn't.
The only thing I remember the only thing I remember from seeing it was long.
Sure.
That was my takeaway as a 14-year-old. So
it is long. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to like this because it's of a genre. And a tone that is so maligned by culture at large, but by pop culture and by high culture, this paperback romance thing, right? But I truly kind of like that.
I do too. Yeah.
I understand it's not like, you know, the highest of high art or the most dramatic of drama. But I have no problem with melodrama. I have no problem with, you know, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. Like, I find those rhythms to be relaxing and comforting. And Corinne said something in the beginning that, you know, I think is fine. You put it in a nice setting. You have two people who meet each other, two lost souls who meet each other. It's almost always going to work for me. So that's one kind of box I would put this in that, you know, I am a little preordained to give this movie every benefit of the doubt.
We did have a conversation when I came on for Runaway Bride in Notting Hill about Kenny liking movies with nice people doing nice things.
I love movies with nice people.
I do too.
That's nice what things. This movie could have been.
Kenny just left.
He just dropped the mic.
Yeah, I'm out here. I have to. My dog was. I don't know if you could hear the dog in the background, but he was just freaking out to get in here.
Yeah,
because he wants to talk about sight. At
first sight.
There are a lot of dogs in the movie.
So that there are. So that is the first kind of place I'd like to center the conversation in its genre, in its subgenre. The other thing that I think is interesting about this movie. Is you guys listen to the Script Notes podcast?
Sometimes. Jinx.
Perfect answer. Have you ever heard them do How Would This Be a Movie?
No.
Where they get pitched an article or there's a piece of news or there's something in the media or whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
And would this make a good movie? I don't know if it's How Would This Be a Movie. It's Would This Make a Good Movie?
Mm-hmm.
If you hear the story of one of the first 20 people in the world, to regain his sight.
Yeah.
And then a year later, because this is based on a real guy named Cheryl Jennings, who this really happened to.
Yep.
He regained his sight, and then he lost it again a year later. Spoiler alert. You would think this would make a good movie.
It begs to be a movie. It does, yeah.
This does not make a good movie in any form. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the natural arc is there. It's a really interesting story in a magazine or I believe it was published in a series of essays, but it does not make for a good movie. And then a third box, there is the part about it that I really want to talk about, which is differently abled people.
Yeah.
Mm, right.
Well, that's yeah.
That's a that conversation. Yeah.
I am not convinced. I'm convinced this is a horrible portrayal of blind people.
Oh yeah.
But I am not. I don't know how to tackle this one, to be honest, because this is an interesting conversation for our moment. It's a lot easier, I think, for people to say BIPOC people have not been represented behind the scenes on the writing staff and directing, but BIPOC people make up 40% of the population. We have clearly fucked up here, right? That's obvious. Mm-hmm. And we can raise these voices. Blind people do not make up any large percentage of this population, right? And then on top of that, film is a visual medium. It's very hard to find someone who is both blind and capable of making a film. How do you tell a story about a blind person with sensitivity and grace and inclusion without having necessarily people who don't understand that experience involved in essential ways? So those are the three things.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess we should. We'll talk about all three of those boxes because I think that they're all completely valid. I'll say first and foremost that I of the three, the only one that I potentially kind of just disagree with is the notion that this story isn't inherently filmable or couldn't have been executed better. I think they could have done a better job. I think a better movie could have been made here. And I think that, you know, Oliver Sacks, who's this essay, this film is based on an essay that he wrote a bit on these real people that you mentioned, Kenny. You know, Oliver Sacks was also the guy behind Awakenings. Robin Williams played Oliver Sacks in that film. You know, Oliver Sacks had sort of a history of situations like this, if you will, people that had these sort of, you know, momentary, unusual momentary sort of biological medical thing happen to them that changes their perspective and then puts them back into the perspective they had previously. It happened a couple times to him as a doctor.
So he's a bad doctor, is what you're saying.
No, or a very, very good doctor, but only briefly.
That is the doctor in this film.
Yeah. What is that? The reason that I bring that up, and I think that Awakenings is a good thing to point to, is because Awakenings is, for all intents and purposes, the better version of this, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, people that were in these comatose states that were given this medicine that allowed them to wake up, but only briefly, and then they went back to sleep.
Well, that's a great idea for a movie.
Yes, that is a better film. but I also just think that part of the issues here, Kenny, and I think it touches on all three of the boxes that you're talking about, is the writing and is the direction, right? And is the performances, like the various things that make the film, and how all of those things don't meet a standard in this film, right?
Yeah,
go ahead, Greg.
I would agree that I think they actually put in a lot of the like foundation for a good movie. They just don't ever build.
Yeah.
They just put it down. They're like, that works. Let's just keep going. Like, there's a cool, interesting story sort of in the background of whatever's going on that they just didn't.
Sometimes.
There's potential.
There's an inherent problem with this story, and also I think Awakenings, that the filmmakers want to tell, and the story that the audience is comfortable hearing, is the story of the able-bodied person, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in Awakenings, it's the story of Robin Williams and his experience with the Robert De Niro character.
Yeah.
That has its own inherent problem, which is that it reduces the person who is suffering to a magical person, to essentially a magical plot dilemma, right? Who only exists to help your protagonist grow as a person.
Correct.
So that's one way to do it that I would argue is kind of shitty, but I would also say just breaking it down to the essentials, it works as a movie.
Like
it
Rain just, Man? Like that kind
of
thing?
Well, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It works as a movie, but it reduces a character to a
plot device.
Right.
A plot device.
A magical superhuman.
So it's hard, right? It's hard because Rayman is like the best version of this. And Rayman is a fantastic movie, but Rayman also like suffers from this problem.
Yeah.
Now, the reverse is in Awakenings or Rain Man, really, but Awakenings, you can't tell the story from Robert De Niro's point of view. It's impossible, right? In this movie, you have to tell the story at least partially from Val Kilmer's point of view because he is, you know, completely of sound mind before, during, and after. But what that does is it necessitates that someone actually tries to understand what that kind of person goes through. And I think that's fairly impossible for a sighted person. I think that's fairly impossible. So I think that's essentially what I feel like is a real problem. Now, don't get me like we will go on the Mira Sorvino character's journey, which sucks. And she sucks. And she does sucky things throughout this movie. And it's a mess.
I mean, part of the issue for me too is that I don't think that Virgil, Val Kilmer's character, that his story outside of his sight is a particularly interesting story, or that they do a particularly good job sort of unpacking it. I mean, I think the stuff with the dad is clunky as shit. I mean, I think all that stuff doesn't really – so what you're left with, Kenny, and I think this is part of your point, is that the whole thing is hanging on one idea – and that's the idea of this man who gets his sight back, and everything else is just sort of phoned in.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we've got this great thing. This guy, he was blind, and then he wasn't blind, and then he was blind again. Isn't that a story? And it's like,
it's funny because my biggest problem with this movie is the fact that it seems to be about this woman who's trying to fix a man who's not broken.
That too.
It's like, it's either a reverse Pretty Woman at best, or at worst, it's about a nitpicky, naggy woman who just wants to be like, oh, but I'm being helpful. You need to do all these things for me. Like, that's my biggest issue.
Well, and I'll piggyback on that and say that, you know, part of it as well, Kenny, speaks to the ableness, right? Which is that it's like he was fine, right? Like, he had figured when he was blind, when we meet him, he seems like a very content, very happy person.
He's not broke.
And then society says, you're broken. We need to fix you.
But she says it. Nobody else is saying it. Everybody else is like,
also, I agree with everything you said. And that's like what I'm getting out with the Mira Sorvino character. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I was hoping, and it's a very big ask of a movie in 1999, but what I was hoping was when she had the conversation with the sister, the sister said what you're saying.
Yep.
Because then I get what this movie is at least trying to do.
Yeah.
But what the sister said was, we tried. Don't get me wrong. Like, there's nothing he wants more than to be sighted. We tried. It's fucking hard. Not going to do it.
Yep.
That puts being sighted in a superior position to being blind. Right?
Well,
that says you are inherently broken when you are blind, and any reasonable person would want that. This is the point
thesis,
of view of this movie.
Yeah, I agree.
Any reasonable person would want to be sighted. Now, I want to say another thing.
Yeah.
That's not crazy to me if you actually explore it, right? If you present both sides of that, if Val Kilmer is the one saying, on one hand, you know, like, I do want to see the horizon, but on the other hand, like, I am doing just fine right now. I think that I speak from a little bit of experience on this because on a show that I work on right now on Step Up, which you could see, we have a character who's a double amputee. And there is this omnipresent question. And on the show, he's in a wheelchair. In real life, he walks with prosthesis. So there is a constant conversation about whether or not we should tell the story of this character getting prosthetics. And these conversations come up all the time. Now, the difference is not, of course, is we can ask him, and we do,
Yeah.
Difference to that, there are people who can help us with this journey. But what I think is happening, and what I'm nervous about, and why I think this movie is a somewhat noble failure in its own disgusting way, is these are very hard stories to tell. And my concern is people will not try to tell them anymore because they're hard stories to tell. You see what I'm saying?
Well, you know, it's funny. I totally know what you're saying. And as you were talking, I was thinking about there was a storyline actually on ER that they did back. I think it was in season three, if I'm not mistaken, where Benton has a son who is deaf. And he's born deaf. And it grapples with exactly sort of what you're talking about, Kenny, which is it also speaks to this film a little bit too, which is a father who doesn't know how to process the fact that his child has a disability of some sort. And Benton sort of struggles with this and takes his son to see a specialist. And she says to him, this is part of his identity. You know, this is part of who he is. And you can't rob him of that. I mean, mm-hmm. to try to sort of do sort of implants and do all sorts of various things in an attempt to try to make him quote unquote normal or like everybody else, you know, there is a community of deaf people. There's a community of blind people. There's a community of amputees, and they're embraced. Like this is actually a beautiful thing, and it's part of what makes this person special. And I think unfortunately, as a society, we don't deal with that very well. We want everyone to fit into a very specific box. And you know, one of the things that I think this film could have done better was to unpack the father's character, unpack that stuff, see the what could have been done with that. But instead, they throw it away with this crappy scene at the end, and they shoehorn in this, you know, they needed essentially a journey for Virgil to go on. So they kind of made the dad this journey, sort of, but not really. But all this is a long way of saying that, to your point, Kenny, if we could see both sides of this argument, they don't even really do it with the Kelly McGillis character either, with his sister either. Like, it's just, for whatever reason, this movie is a very straight line when it just didn't need to be.
And what's interesting is that they do try and do this thing of, like, in its own horrible backwards way, they're trying to say, like, he was better off blind. That's who he was. That's how we got it. Right. That's what they're trying to get at.
Yep.
But the journey to get to that point is so muddled and so poorly done without exploring those nuances. It's more just like seeing is tough. And like, isn't it interesting that like you take it for granted? Like that you can tell where things are and how fast things are coming at you and what an apple is. Like that's stuff you need to learn again. If you had to see, isn't that cool?
Yeah.
And that's not really the journey, but they were trying to come to that thing of like, he was better off on his own, but
I fully agree. There's a part of me, I was watching this film and I was thinking that, you know, I like medical stories. I like the idea of literal and metaphorical. I love the idea of this guy who all of a sudden has to relearn his brain needs to relearn how to process one of his senses. And I think that that's an interesting thing, right? I mean, that's ultimately what some executive who decided they wanted to buy this, you know, essay thought, right? Mm-hmm. But then on top of that, you have a screenwriter who doesn't have any subtext, just has people say everything. There is nothing going on underneath the surface of this film. You know, and that does an enormous disservice. But I think there's something fundamentally fascinating about someone having to essentially relearn how to see the world. Like, I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
But you can't, that's not the whole fucking thing. You can't that's hang what a whole
they,
movie
yeah,
on
they
that.
They put the like, whole movie into that realm. And it's like, that's
you got to tell stories. Like, Amy's story still needs to be interesting. It can't just be like, I'm an architect and I have an ex-husband. It's like, it's just, there needs to be more to it than that.
I'm mad. I need to go to this country to get relaxed.
Yeah. It's like, it's hard to feel sorry for.
There are two things I think we're talking about here. One is this movie ill-conceived?
Yeah.
Which I think it is. Yeah. And probably. Two is this movie incompetently executed? Which I think it is.
It's both of these things.
It is an ill-conceived movie. It is the worst version of a movie that probably shouldn't have been made.
You're saying it's bad on two levels then, not
I'm
just
saying one. It's bad on two levels. But what I'm Yeah, so I guess that's kind of like where I differ from you guys, which is like, yeah, these are all bad decisions.
Yeah.
But good decisions aren't so great either. Right? Like the I'm trying to think of like the documentary version of this, right? Because that would be something fascinating. Like, all right, so I'll put it this way. The bad execution destroys any chance of it being the movie you wanted it to be, Phil. The movie where you actually get into this guy's head and understand what it's like to like regain a sense out of nowhere. That problem comes from, I think, Val Kilmer's performance, the script. There's no verisimilitude to this, which makes me doubt everything I'm seeing, right? So whether or not any of this is real, I can't discern that whatsoever. Because I don't believe that what they're telling me is the truth. I believe what they're telling me is a fake version of this guy's life. And that, to me, falls pretty heavily on Val Kilmer's performance. It, it's very, to be a baby.
It's very interesting to watch a film that's based on a true story where they actually talk to the real guy who was blind and they still get it so wrong. Like, that's an amazing accomplishment.
Well, it's an interesting thing, right? But because I have – I mean – I have virtually no experience with this, and not zero. So my brother-in-law's sister is blind, and so I'm around a blind person all the time. So I have some sense of what it actually, you know, feels like to interact with a blind person on a regular basis. And, you know, there are certain things that are different from interacting with, you know, a sighted person, of course. But I do know to some extent that Val Kilmer's performance adds a mental element that just isn't there.
Oh, right? I mean, his decision to smile throughout this entire movie. Yeah. And the first thing we see him do, one of the first things we see him do, is get on a literal school bus for children.
It's
never explained. They're like, this guy needs to take the school bus. And there's a bunch of kids on there too. Then they're all like 8 or 9 years old.
Well, what they do is
never explain it.
Because now you're getting into like you're making a very good point. Now you're getting into like this part that like really, really destroys the movie to me, which is it's the pumpkin element of it, right?
Yeah.
Where pumpkin. You start the Christina Ricci movie where she, you know, starts dating a mentally impaired person.
Oh. Yep. Okay.
And you start to wonder like, all right, now is this uncomfortable for me? Like, is this an uncomfortable? Is there an uncomfortable difference between these two intellectually, which there shouldn't be? But the way Val Kilmer plays and the way the movie presents this character, particularly what you're talking about with the child school bus and his childlike wonder at everything in the world and his omnipresent smile, and when he's particularly when he before he you know regains his sight, the way he has no oscillation. He's just happy.
It's
like kind of dicey territory. But what I was saying is I actually don't know much about the way this would be. Who does? Like who knows anything about the way this would be? This has happened so few times in humanity. So if you told me that this is exactly how it is, I would believe you if you were a doctor. But this movie gives me no confidence that it can present the truth to me.
Right.
Because I feel like
This guy's not a real come off like a real person.
You guys are tapping into two things that I think we should certainly unpack or talk about. The first is that this movie is sort of medically mushy. You know, we really only have like kind of two scenes with a doctor who seems, if I'm being completely honest, mildly competent, but not like
he's like Dr. Nick Riviera from The Simpsons. Like, hi, everybody.
He definitely has that vibe. Like, there's he shows up and he seems very confident. He's like, I can fucking give you your eyesight back. Then he does this surgery. It works, but like the scene when, and we'll talk about it, but the scene when he gets his eyesight back for the first time is not handled particularly well by that doctor. He doesn't really have any, he points a fucking camera at him with like lights and shit. So there's that. And then later when like he starts losing his sight, he's in this tiny little office and he's just like, well, I don't know, man. I guess it's going away now. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you. You're like, well, you got to give me more than that. So you've got the medical kind of unfortunate, not feeling particularly solid. And then like, your Nathan Lane Good Will Hunting-esque sort of scenario of like a doctor, pseudoscience sort of what have you. So there's that, which we'll definitely talk about. But then I want to also just talk about what you were saying in terms of the childlike component, because just recently I watched Forrest Gump again.
Me too.
With some friends.
Oh, let's talk
then,
about that.
And then last night I rewatched Elf for the first time in a long time as well. And I think both of those are examples of sort of childlike wonder that have romantic entanglements that just make you go, are they being sort of like, is this a balanced scenario? Like, is the way that Jenny treats Forrest in Forrest Gump and the way that Will Ferrell and Zooey Deschanel have their relationship in Elf, which is a much sweeter, kinder, playful sort of thing, which is different, but still feels like there's a person in this equation that has perhaps a more mature perspective on things, and then this childlike component, which I just don't know how to feel about.
Yeah, it's almost like the director was like, Val Kilmer, don't be bummed. Just be happy that you're like this. Yeah. And he was like, yeah. Okay. But the other thing is, like, this movie takes away, unlike Forrest Gump, who has like agency and does stuff and has yes. a life.
Virgil seems to have none.
This yeah. guy's like, I'm not even going to go home when I get my vision back. I'm just going to stay in the city with this chick I just shacked up with. Like, it's just, I feel like it's just like, that's the, I don't know. He just doesn't really have a life or a story, and to hang all this stuff yeah. on him when he's not doing anything. I did literally write down, is he a child? He takes the school bus. He's talking to his dog like a friend. Is he a child? He says, that's my friend Bruce. Sometimes we watch the game together. Is he a child? He acts like a 14-year-old. Like, no, not that's
no, generous. Not even 14.
He acts like those 8-year-olds that he's yeah. on the school bus with. And it's just like anything that happens after that is established is just yeah. completely incredible.
Well, it's sorry.
That's not it. I mean, honestly, having an 8-year-old and having a 3-year-old, that's a lot closer to 3.
I think that you make a really good point, Corinne, about how they want him. It's a fine line, and they unfortunately tip over it on many occasions, which is they want him to seem at blissful, like blissful about the world around him, right? Which sure, fine. I mean, I don't necessarily have a problem with a person who's just positive. Like, being a positive person and being childlike are two very different things, and they vacillate between those two things in a way that does the film a disservice.
Yeah, and like Forrest Gump is never, Tom Hanks is, I mean, God, we can't even compare them. It's like apples and fucking rocks or something.
But, apples and rocks?
Apples but like, and pictures of apples?
Tom Hanks is never acting like, he's acting like this person, you know? And he's never just like gazing at sure. things. Like, he's just like, oh, I went to the White House again.
Well, he's also
meet the president again.
He's also given pretty, yeah. look, I don't think Forrest Gump's a great film, but he's also given a pretty we can talk about Forrest Gump. He's also given a pretty specific, well-written, well-informed, well-drawn character who would talk like that, would think like that. There is nothing about being a blind person that also makes you a simple person. And that is like, that is kind of the cardinal sin of this movie. That is like the... Yeah. That is the original sin of this movie. You take that, and then the other thing, which is done probably more for efficiency than anything else, but it's a big fucking problem, is like Mira Sorvino meets him, sleeps with him, and then says it's time to change him.
Immediately.
It would be one thing if this was someone, I assume the real person was based on, I believe her name was Barbara Jennings?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
I assume that relationship lasted more than one night before they decided, let's go on.
I think they were engaged or something. Like, they were into that relationship.
Which is the movie. Which, like, at least then they could have honest adult conversations about the implications of doing this and the way in which, like, she is trying to save him from something he doesn't necessarily need to be saved from, or that he doesn't necessarily need someone to help him save, be rescued from.
Yeah.
So it's – So the Mira Sorvino component of it is like one of those things you do when you're making a movie or a television show to, you know, to kind of yada, yada, yada through the boring bits, but it destroys her character, and it destroys any chance of these characters having any kind of adult, meaningful connection. Yeah.
There's also, you know, I think it speaks volumes about the fact that we were just talking about Forrest Gump and Elf, both of which are, essentially sort of fables, if you will. Like, they're both, I mean, they don't exist necessarily in our reality. And the fact that this film unsuccessfully tries to balance the tone of grounded medical advancement and a whimsical protagonist who seems to exist on some other plane is just problematic. But let me read the synopsis for our listeners who might not have seen this film. In the midst of desperately needing a vacation, cynical Manhattanite Amy Bennett, played by Mira Sorvino, meets blind massage therapist Virgil Adamson, played by Val Kilmer. Fascinated by his independence and seduced by his positivity, Bennett falls hard for him. As their relationship deepens, the two...
It's not untrue.
This is Google. As their relationship deepens, the two plan to leave the tiny resort town Adamson knows by touch for the hustle and bustle of New York City, where Bennett suggests he undergo a cutting-edge medical procedure that could repair his sight. This film was written by Steve Levitt, based on Oliver Sacks' To See or Not See. It was directed by Irwin Winkler. At First Sight opened on January 15th, 1999, in fifth place with $2.2 million, behind Varsity Blues and a couple 1998 Oscar players, Civil Action, Thin Red Line, and Patch Adams. It would go on to make $22.2 million on a $60 million budget. $60 million. Insane. It has 32% of Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 46% from critics. Roger Ebert gave it 2 out of 4 stars. He said, the Oliver Sacks case study that inspired At First Sight tells the story of a man who's grown accustomed to blindness and then is offered an operation that will restore sight. The moment when the bandages are removed from his eyes all but cries out to be filmed, but to have sight suddenly thrust upon you can be a dismaying experience. The most striking moment in At First Sight is when our hero is able to see for the first time since he was 3. This isn't right, he says, frightened by the rush of images. There's something wrong. This can't be seeing. And then desperately, give me something in my hand so that he can associate a familiar touch with an unfamiliar sight. If the movie had trusted the fascination of this scene, it might have gone somewhere interesting. Unfortunately, its moments of fascination and its good performances are mired in the morass of romance and melodrama that surrounds it. A blind man can see, and still he's trapped in a formulaic studio plot. I mean, that sounds about right.
No, it's true. It's like, why did they make this a love story? For marketing,
because,
I guess?
To because they're lazy.
Yeah. It's about this guy's, it should be about this guy's journey. It's a big deal that he gets his eyesight back. He doesn't also need to fall in love with some chick.
I totally agree.
It's so much more interesting if they're together for a period of time and then they can have the frank conversations.
It's a meditation on marriage, you know, and change.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
This has been
about a man who had been married to this woman for however many years and then all of a sudden regains his sight, and it's about what that does to their marriage. Immediately, we've already made a better movie.
I'm in. He gets to see his wife for the first time. They've been married for 10 years. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know what it's a little bit like?
Yeah.
A movie that everyone hates, but I love.
Oh, no. The Net? I love that.
Directed, directed by
Irwin Winkler.
I know.
This is follow-up.
I know.
I'm going to bring that up later. Round 2. Let's go. a little bit like Indecent Proposal. The pitch you just pitched.
Yes.
Is that the one where Demi Moore lies on a bed of money? Okay.
Correct.
Yes. It's the one where she's offered $1 million. Or and
Woody from Cheers Woody. Is there? Okay.
Yes.
Woody from Cheers.
Woody's better than, I mean, anyway.
Woody Harrelson.
I love Cheers.
The Oscar-nominated Woody Harrelson.
Guys, Woody Harrelson's name is Woody in Cheers. I just got that. Oh, they used his real name.
God. This is amazing. Corinne just had a moment.
Guys.
Woody from Cheers.
Yeah, Woody from Cheers is in it too, guys. Yeah, but yeah, so Woody and Demi are offered $1 million for Robert Redford to spend one night with her. Is that basically the gist of it?
And roll around on a bed filled with money.
Yeah. Sundance get offers.
They get $1 million in cash.
But it tears them apart, right? That's the idea.
Sleep with G.I. Jane. And then it tears them apart and then pulls them back together. It's the exact arc of like what I think you would talk about.
Yes.
Yes. You know, something is fundamentally like missing in their marriage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Money. They have no money. They're struggling. They're offered a, you know, ladder to have some money.
What's missing here? Money. Darling, we need money.
So wait, is Robert Redford eyesight in this equation? Is that
Robert Redford's the doctor who can offer the thing.
Okay. So that literalizes
the doctor who can offer the thing. Yeah. But the thing is, in that movie, she does get like temporarily seduced. Like, there's not a moment in this movie where Val Kilmer's like, this is great. Like, we made the right choice.
There's kind of a small moment of that where they're skating.
There is a small moment, but it should be a bigger moment.
It should.
He loses it at the end, and it should be tragic, right? Like,
yeah, it's like kind of a relief when he loses it.
It is a relief.
I agree with you 100%.
Actually, the thing is, like, I thought the last half hour.
Well, I think what we're tapping in.
Uh-huh.
I was like, there was a moment where, I didn't read about this before. I didn't read the article before, and I didn't read Cheryl Jennings' real life story before, so I didn't know he lost it at the end. And when that happened, that kind of hit me as like, on one hand, okay, that's so obvious. That's a great place to go with the story. And two, like, that's so sad. Like, that is like genuinely sad to me that like he went through all this bullshit, walked through it. It's like Andy Dufresne going through his 3 miles of shit and then having the warden there waiting for him at the end, you know? So that was affected to me just as a human being, but they could have gotten him to the point where he was – you know, kind of making his way through. But I think the last thing that happened was he found the cotton candy and then like he really like just like truly lost it, like kind of in a harrowing way. But
yeah,
can I part of the thing it taps into what you're saying, Kenny, which is that, and what you were saying as well, Karim, which is he was happy at the beginning. He had built a life for himself that he was happy, he understood, and then this woman comes into his life and says, but what if you could see? And then he's like, I mean, I guess. Okay. I mean, I'll try this. So he's never, he never seems to really want it. And then for him to get his eyesight back and for it to be so jarring and awful would also just be like, well, fuck this. Like, I was fine before.
Yeah.
So it as tragic as I agree with you, Kenny, it should be, in order for the tragedy of it to hit harder, he needs to be a little happier with the experience of being able to see. And yet the happiness component, I put that in quotation marks, is him searching for the horizon like a bit of a crazy person in the middle of the night, like running around the city and her not really understanding what's going on. Like, it's just a jumbled mess of ideas.
Yeah. And I feel like what they were trying to do was like tie Mira Sorvino to his dad. Kind of, and be like, his dad left him because all of the procedures didn't work. She's going to leave me. And like, I was like, well, why aren't we? That's why he like holds back on telling her that it's going away, I think. Yeah. But it's like, they don't really make that. Like, that would have been, if you're not going to make him sad about losing the eyesight, I kind of get that. If you make him sad about her finding out because he thinks she's going to leave him, first of all, good riddance to this chick. She's the worst. Second of all, that would make more sense to me.
Yeah.
By the way, like, that dad should have fallen off a crane.
Yeah.
Like, you shouldn't even have a job. Like, he is such. Was that?
I don't understand why. I really genuinely do not understand why he left. I don't. I genuinely don't understand why this, like, well-to-do man is on a construction site.
Yeah.
Just in the middle of the city randomly.
And he's Ken Howard, who, like, always plays decent guys. Like, what is happening here? Like, get the fuck out of here. Like, I mean, like, honestly, like, an anvil should fall on his head. Like, what a horrible thing to do.
Yeah, but,
so, all right, I think this conversation has helped me understand what I think is the fundamental problem with this type of story. Because this, at first sight, posits that being blind is a problem that any human would want to fix, right?
Yeah, a giant assumption.
But I would think, I mean, also I think it's like, but that's not our point because he's better off. I don't know. I guess you're right. Yeah, okay, keep going.
I think that's at least the premise. And then I think I think maybe the movie can be read as like, ultimately it is better to be, you know, whatever, comfortable than, I have no idea. But I think the premise is like anybody would want this ailment fixed.
Right.
I think there's a current idea that we discussed and talking about, you know, Eric LaSalle's character and all that stuff and what I've experienced, which is this is not a problem. This is part of a person's part of a person's existence and their identity, and it should be essentially left alone. And the problem with both of these is these are views from the outside, from able-bodied people looking inwards. This is how we should deal with people who are differently abled. We should change them in 1999. We should step off in 2020. But what we should or not do anything. But what we really need to do, I think, is just ask them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think the problem with this movie is. Because I the thing that keeps like kind of getting at me is like, it's not so simple as this is a problem for every person that needs to be fixed. And it's not so simple as this is not a problem for every person that should be left alone. It's different for every person. Right? It has to be different for every person.
Right. Right.
And as someone who is sighted, I can't possibly understand it. Mm-hmm. But the weird thing about it is like Mira Sorvino finds the article among Val Kilmer's like stuff, his like nostalgia book. And a lot of the stuff in his nostalgia book has Braille, so it's obviously for him. This article doesn't have Braille. This article is highlighted, and I assume it's from his sister, right? Why else would it be there?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what that says to me is like one of two things, but the more interesting reading is like she read this to him at some point and he kept it, right? He kept it in a safe place and it's on his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could unpack the pros and the cons, the consequences and why he wants this and why he wouldn't.
Yeah.
And then I begin to like understand the stakes for this particular guy.
Yeah. A scene with him and the sister, like, or when he's telling Mira Sorvino, like, my sister and I talked about this and we decided. And she's like, well, did you guys decide that or did she decide? He's like, well, she's been taking care of me. I have to listen to her. And she's like, if it's more about, because that's kind of a weird relationship that he has with his sister. And she's the one who's like, think for yourself. What's your, you know, like, that's kind of our way in. Then
it's, I mean, not. Not to put too fine a point on it, but we're really talking about like screenwriting 101 here in terms of just the idea of stakes. And unfortunately, the movie puts all of its stakes, everything on the romance.
Yeah.
Will these two make it, right? These two, this their love is everything. So, which I think we can all safely say is not a great idea. Like if you're putting all your chips on that, you better have two incredible actors that have just like unbelievable chemistry. And these two have fine chemistry, but like they don't have unbelievable chemistry.
Maybe in a different movie, but I completely agree. The chemistry was a disaster.
So it's everything. And, you know, it's kind of what I was grappling with as I was watching the film, just being like, what am I supposed to be invested in? Like, what am I supposed to care about?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is Virgil's journey? What is Amy's journey?
You're hitting it. This goes back to like my initial point, which is like everything about this movie says Virgil is the one who has the interesting journey.
Yep.
And the only reason Amy is given the preferential spot is because she's able-bodied. And that's it. That's all she has, like, quote unquote, over him.
Yep.
But it is her POV. We start the movie with her. We end the movie with her. Like, it is. But again, like, she has no journey. Like,
no.
Her journey. Well, I guess she was divorced.
She makes that sculpture, Kenny.
She finishes
her sculpture. That's her. Her journey.
I mean, by the way, both of them. It's fucking brutal. The very last scene of this movie, I'm jumping around, but the very last scene of the film is them sitting on a fucking park bench. And she says to him, I rebuilt the sculpture and it's so beautiful. And then he says, I saw the horizon. I know it's not possible to touch it, but like some bullshit like that. Like
it's
literally like they say their journeys out loud to each other in the final scene of this movie. Like it's crazy to me that, you know, not that this movie was made, because listen, it's 1999, it's a different time, but it feels like $60 million, that's $100 million or close to it in 2020 dollars, on a movie that, by the way, looks like shit. Like, it doesn't look like $60 million. My guess is that Val probably had a $10 million something around there in terms of his
maybe quote. Vera Sorvino, too. Didn't she win an Oscar? And
she did, but she's not getting 10. Like, but still, like, but like, it's just, it's crazy to me that nobody at MGM was like, you know, maybe we shouldn't hit it totally on the head. Like, maybe the end shouldn't be a literal distillation of their journeys. But, you know, that's where we're at. I want to give just a little bit more context in terms of like how we got here in terms of Val Kilmer's career, because we haven't had a Val Kilmer movie thus far in the run. And I do think he has a fascinating, if odd, career. You know, he obviously comes onto the scene in Top Secret, which I saw for the first time a couple weeks ago. Very funny movie. Top Gun, Willow. I mean, these are – then The Doors really kind of puts him on the map. A great performance.
Oh, God.
Tombstone, he's very good in. Then he gets Batman in 95.
I watched The Doors during the pandemic for the first time. Let's talk about that night where I just left. Sat in my room and read a book. So I was like, I can't.
I walked out of your own living room.
Out of my own living room and into the bedroom and said, not for me, friend. That's my
I've
boyfriend.
Done that.
It's fair. So in 1995, he does Batman and Heat, which is a fucking great year. Obviously, it's sort of it's kind of the peak of the mountain for him. He notoriously was very difficult on Batman. He's not asked to come back. He does.
He's a very weird guy.
He's a weird dude.
He
does Island of Dr. Moreau. He does The Saint, which was sort of his last attempt at trying to be a big kind of big movie star franchise player. That movie obviously was
one of my least favorite movies.
It's not a very good movie. And now we're at 99 and he does At First Sight. So there's a part of me that feels like he probably thought this was an Oscar play, is my guess.
Is this the kind of movie that would win Oscars back in the day? Like this?
The best possible version of this, he maybe gets an Oscar nomination, right? I feel like in the best possible version.
And then he heard it was coming out in January. He was like, well, that's
the one.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
But I that's true. It's a very good point. I think that, you know, it's kind of like the apt pupil to Awakening Shawshank or Awakening Stand By Me. You know what I mean? Like, it's the next thing from this guy who kind of has a track record in this world. Like, if you're going to do an Afflicted story, this guy is the guy who you go to and you might get nominated for an Oscar. So I was the same thing with Mira Sorvino because, you know, there's that one part where it's so awful where she's like he's like, take off your clothes, essentially. And she's like, well, if you're going to see me, you should see all of me.
Yeah.
And she kind of disrobes, and I'm thinking, oh, Mira, for this movie, like you're putting yourself.
We don't see the goods.
Well, we see behind a well placed curtain
screen,
which of course everybody has in their apartment where they live alone.
She was separating like the living space from the sleeping space. I can fault her for a lot. I can't fault her on her decor in that apartment.
That's fair.
God.
But yes, I do think it was a bit of an Oscar play. But it leads me to another kind of Val question, which is there's been this thing that happened with Keanu over the last 10 years where people started to say, you know what? Actually, he's really good. Right?
Yep.
And that's Keanu. Same thing happened like with Nicolas Cage where people were like, you know what? He's actually really good. This kind of happened with Val Kilmer at some point.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Around Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yep.
Where people were like, actually, he's really good. And then it's the same thing with like Keanu and Nicolas Cage. You start looking back at those performances where you're like, and you're like, wait a second. This shit was good. And this happened with Val with like, I mean, when you were going through Heat, it's a great example, right? For 20 years, Heat was Pacino, De Niro. And then people started to like rediscover like, wait a sec.
Yeah.
Val Kilmer's amazing. Yeah. So like the question I have is like, is Val Kilmer a great actor? Or even a good actor or a bad actor?
I think Val Kilmer is legitimately a great actor. I think he's a prickly person. And I think he probably, you know, was drinking his own Kool-Aid a little bit in the, you know, in the mid 90s. And I think that, which
he's
by the way, like,
looking guy. He's like,
very,
He's crazy good looking.
No, guys, no.
Well, that's my opinion.
He's extremely. That's fair, but he's very blonde. I'll say that.
He is very blonde. But I do think it should be said. Seeing Top Secret for the first time a few weeks ago, I was kind of like, if I saw that guy in whatever year it was, 84 or something like that, like, it's a breath of fresh air. Like, he is all in. This is a Juilliard actor who goes all in on a broad, silly comedy, and he's fucking
brilliant.
Great in it.
He is. He's
like,
brilliant.
It's a movie star performance that you're just like, well, this guy's obviously going to be huge. And truthfully, it's just sort of, it's wobbly and weird, but like, he gets his cracks. And I hear you, Corinne, that The Doors might not be the best movie in the world, and I don't think it is, but he's fucking great as Jim Morrison in the movie. I mean, it's an amazing performance.
I think that the thing about Val Kilmer is that he is a comedic actor, or at least in an element, the things that he does best are the things of levity. And when he tries to do this like soapy dramatic stuff, like this movie is just like, no, I mean, the best part about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is that he's so funny. And then The Doors, he's also playing kind of like a whatever. I don't know. I didn't finish it.
I totally agree with you. He is playing a character in The Doors. He's playing he's not playing Jim Morrison as Jim Morrison. He's playing Jim Morrison as pop culture's understanding of Jim Morrison.
Exactly, yeah.
It's fun. He does the same thing in True Romance, right? Yeah. Like, he is Elvis in True Romance, and you never see him in Focus.
Yeah.
But he's playing, you know, pop culture's like kind of larger understanding of this guy. Mm-hmm. He's also, you know, honestly, he's the best part of Entourage Season 1 when he plays the Sherpa. I didn't even know it was him.
I forgot he was in Entourage. That's right.
He was so funny.
He's a funny guy.
Mm-hmm. He is a fun guy. He's a weirdo, and I mean that in the best possible way. I think you're totally right about Val Kilmer, which I don't even know why he went here.
Yeah, there's like some moments of funniness. I'm like, this movie becomes so much better if you're making jokes, and Val Kilmer can do that stuff.
I really think a lot of it comes back to, you know, Kenny, we've talked a lot about like chasing Oscars and whether people should or shouldn't do it, and I think that this felt like. Don't do it. But I also think that, you know, you look at that trajectory of that career, right? And it's like, you know, he sees how he might have fucked up with Batman. He tries to do it with the Saint. It's like he sees it's getting away from him. And then this role of this script lands on his desk. I get it. Like, I get why he does it. He shouldn't have done it. And understandably, like, Irwin Winkler is the wrong person to direct this. I think that in a director's hands that was, I don't want to say more competent, although that is probably the right word, but a director that's just sort
right
of that, a director that at least understands the material a little bit better. This movie might have been a little bit of an Oscar player. Like, this to me, actually, Kenny feels like, Kenny and I were texting about the podcast, It Has Oscar Buzz. And there's a part of me that's like, I'm sure this movie didn't, but like, there's a version of this where this is a movie that ends up on that podcast. You know what I mean? Where it's like, people talked for a little bit about maybe a Val Kilmer. I mean, he's really good as the blind guy or whatever it is. And I mean, that being Hollywood, whatever. But like, looking at Irwin Winkler's directing career for a quick second here, you know,
before you get into Irwin Winkler.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course he thought this was an Oscar play.
Yeah.
A drama about a drama where a real life sighted person plays an afflicted person.
Yep.
Of course you think that, like, you, if you knock this out of the park, you get an Oscar for it. It's like, it's happened so many times. Like,
yeah.
Yep. Jamie Foxx and that exact role. Tom Hanks and yep. Daniel Day-Lewis, and it goes on and on and on. Like, that this is classic kind of Oscar stuff. This is what was lampooned in what was the Ben Stiller movie? In Tropic Thunder.
Tropic Thunder, yeah.
So this is it. That's, of course, he thought he could maybe win an Oscar, but I'm so happy he really only seemed to try it once.
I also just say, too, just sorry, very quickly, Corinne, I think that part of that Oscar thing, too, Kenny, is say what you will about Irwin Winkler as a director, and I don't think that he's a particularly great director. As a producer, Rocky, Raging Bull, The Right Stuff, Goodfellas, this guy has fucking Oscars all around him. So my guess is that he's like, buddy, I'm going to get you that Oscar nomination.
Was he nominated for The Doors?
No.
He might have been. No, he wasn't?
No. Weirdly, The Doors didn't
Not weird. Agreed. I'm bored.
Not weird. Agreed from Corinne Steigman. Uh-uh. But yeah, it's I don't know. This is one of those things, and we've talked about this a lot on this podcast, but like it's the on paper versus what the film turns out to be, right? I mean, it's easy for us to Monday morning quarterback all of this, but you know, on paper, Oliver Sacks, Erwin Winkler playing a character that struggles with a disability of sorts. I think that all of these things, I get why he did it. It's just, it's so much more likely to play out like this than it's going to play out like the Oscar movie.
I mean, you know what I mean? I will say, I went to go see it. So I was in when I saw that ad. I was like, yeah, this is what I like. I'm in.
God, he's been in some shitty fucking movies. Val? He's been lost. He's been lost in sea for
20, he really has been.
For 15 years.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You really
have. I agree.
He needs to do a comedy. Call his agent. Let's talk to him.
Yeah.
Talk to his agent.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Go ahead.
No, it's just so funny that he started with Top Secret. Like, I think people who can do spoof, like the way that a Val Kilmer did it, often prove to be incredible actors. Like, one of my favorite performances is Chris Evans in Not Another Teen Movie. And it was before he did anything, and he sells it so hard. He acts that movie like he is not even in Varsity Blues, not even in something that's winking at itself at all. He acts like he's in Friday Night Lights. He is so tremendous. Anna Faris in the Scary Movie franchise is shockingly good. Mm-hmm. Better than fucking Nev Campbell in Scream, who I love, and I'm crazy about those movies. Regina Hall is so good in those movies. Like, if you see someone kill it in a spoof, they probably are really good actors.
It's funny as you're saying that. I was thinking about and this might seem strange, but bear with me a second. I watched How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days for the first time yesterday, or a couple days ago. Finished it yesterday. Long story short, the reason I bring this up is you've got Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson, who I think are both fucking great. Like, can be fucking great. And that movie is not, but there's something about, to your point, Kenny, that idea of the instincts of an actor,
yeah,
where they can fucking go there, right? Now, the director needs to know where the dials are in order to sort of modulate to a certain degree understanding. And I don't think that the director of How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days does that. I think, in fact, it's all over the fucking place. But to your point, an actor that a fearlessness to go there is so intrinsic and so important to the DNA of a great career. But then, you know, they can get in their own way, which as we see in Val Kilmer's instance, becomes a problem.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
You mentioned Keanu Reeves, and I kept thinking about The Lake House when I was watching this movie.
Sure.
Because it's similar.
It's the same melodrama, schmaltzy love stuff. But Keanu Reeves in that movie, he's like what you're saying. He gives it. Like, he's like, I'm going to be this like brooding, emotional person. And it, for me, that movie is wonderfully bad. Like, it's bad, but it's great because they're both really invested in giving a great performance. And
you know,
Keanu Reeves knows that it's not going to be a great film, but he's just like, you know what, let's do it.
You know why it's wonderfully bad? For the same reason how to Lose a Guy in 10 Days is wonderfully bad. Because those two people, Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock, can have chemistry like sitting in a fucking dental office Like, they just, there is just something about them that it doesn't matter what they're doing.
They're not even in the same scene for the most of the movie.
Yeah. There's just something about them that you just like, these two people, it's a Meg Ryan Tom Hanks thing.
Yep.
It's a Rachel Ross thing. It's like they're lobsters. You want to see these two people together.
Great reference.
Now, and I would say the same thing. Like I texted with Phil, like all of my issues with How I Met Your Mother while he was not, I mean, how he was a guy in 10 days while he's watching it, which I think is like a diabolical movie.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And yet, like I said, like there are people who think it's actually good, which drives me nuts. But if people thought it was wonderfully bad, I'd be on board. Because like, as horrible as that movie is, when it's raining and they go inside and his house is at an island and they start making out, it's like these two people just have something when they're together that you love and you want. It's the second best chemistry in a bad movie I've ever seen. The best chemistry in a bad movie I've ever seen that like I was so mesmerized by was in the Adjustment Bureau with Matt Damon and Emily Blunt.
With who?
Like Matt Damon and Emily Blunt. There was just something about those two where I'm just like, I don't care how stupid this fucking movie is, and it's the stupidest. It's about special hats that let you go through special walls.
Okay, I want to watch that.
But the two of them, they are so tragically like meant to be together in that movie that I couldn't believe it. But actually, the thing about them that I actually really like is like they're actually only perfect together in a bad movie, I think. If it was a good movie.
Yes, right. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, if it was a good movie, I don't know if I would buy it. But like, does Matt Damon have romantic chemistry with anybody?
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
Wait, let me think about this. What's her name in Good Will Hunting? Minnie Driver.
I agree with that. Emily Blunt. I would say that Emily Blunt actually has had chemistry with people that I'm surprised she has chemistry with. Like, I think I'm not the first person to say this, but she's unbelievably underrated.
Yeah.
Well, that's people. Look, but I people mean, I just, I think about movies that she's been in a bunch of movies that aren't good. Like, I don't think that Emily Blunt, I mean, her career has been weird. But I look at End of Tomorrow. I look at the 15-year engagement, the 5-year engagement, whatever it was with Jason Segel. Mm-hmm. I mean, she finds ways to find chemistry with people that you just wouldn't expect. I mean, except for Mary Poppins, she doesn't really have chemistry with
the children.
No, with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
That's not a romance.
That's not romance. She's like a. She's like,
it's not a romance.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not a romance.
Not a romance.
That's a movie that doesn't exist. Yeah.
But you know what's interesting? You just said Matt Damon. Matt Damon for like a hunky hunk. I don't know. Is that what we say now? Hunks? He's a hunk.
He's a hunky hunk.
He doesn't really have leading ladies. He's usually just like Ocean's 11. He's just kind of on his own. Like, I can't think of any. He hasn't done the rom-com thing.
We bought a zoo.
But he just has, his wife died, but then he meets some girl.
Scarlett Johansson.
They have chemistry.
Does that work? Okay.
Scarlett Johansson's kind of has that Emily Blunt thing where like she could, I mean, she did it as a voice with Joaquin Phoenix, who is unchemistryable. So she's got her and Emily Blunt maybe should do a rom-com together.
Yes.
It might be a chemistry explosion.
Yeah.
Because like the two of them, they really can have chemistry with like mannequins, I think.
Yep. I want to just talk very quickly just about MGM's 1999 for a second, just to sort of, you've got, this is in sequence throughout the year. They start the year with At First Sight, then The Mod Squad, then Kenny's favorite film, The Thomas Crown Affair, then Stigmata, then World Is Not Enough, and they end 99 with Flawless.
That's the worst.
It's not a good year.
Can you run through that one more time?
Sure.
Slowly, though.
At First Sight.
All right.
The Mod Squad.
The worst.
The one with
Claire Danes. Claire Danes and Giovanni Ribisi.
Oh, it's not the one where what's his name wants to be a superhero with Janine Garofalo. Never mind.
Mystery Man.
Also 99, but different film. Okay. The Thomas Crown Affair was a hit, and a lot of people with good taste like it.
I left that theater when I saw it.
You left the theater? God damn it. All right.
15.
It's a terrible movie. One of the worst.
Anyway, Stigmata, which was kind of a sleeper hit for them in September. World Is Not Enough, obviously James Bond did well. And then Flawless was their Oscar play.
What's Flawless? I don't even know.
Flawless is Robert De Niro and Philip Seymour Hoffman. And Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a drag queen who has to help him learn to speak again after a stroke.
It's the movie is not... The movie is not aware that there is a difference between trans people and drag queens.
Well, there's that too. It's troubling, directed by a famous gay person, Joel Schumacher,
who has clearly been around this world. But yeah, what I'm trying to like discern with MGM here is,
I know
it's a very old fashioned view of movie making, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a Bond movie in there. There's a couple of big reboots, attempts at like, you know, this is how we make some money. And then a couple of like old fashioned ideas of how you win Oscars.
Right.
But there's nothing cutting edge in here whatsoever.
No. I mean, you asked earlier, Corinne, if MGM is still around. And it's interesting. The answer to that question is yes. But also Mike DeLuca.
But also no.
Well, no, but Mike DeLuca just recently took it over and has now bought a whole bunch of really interesting prestige-y films from auteurs. Like Paul Thomas Anderson's next film will be an MGM film.
Oh, that's cool.
Like they're trying to revamp MGM and sort of turn it into a far more sort of, you know, I don't want to say cutting edge because that's not really it, but I think that they want to be more of an auteur place, which I think is interesting considering that, you know, you go way back and MGM obviously back in the heyday was, you know, this is Wizard of Oz and, you know, Gone with the Wind and like classic Hollywood. And then they struggle through most of the 80s and 90s to really kind of figure out where they fit in all of this. You know, the only thing they really hold on to is Bond, which they split with Sony so that they can continue to make money off of it. But it's really the only franchise they have. But it's just to your point, Kenny, it's interesting to look at this.
It keeps them afloat. Like the Bond, it's interesting throughout the last 20 years as they have kind of successfully resurrected Bond twice now, or 25 years.
Yep.
That one franchise has been able to keep this movie studio above water to the point where I do think like there is some prestige, particularly if the line is led by the Paul Thomas Andersons of the world to making an MGM movie potentially, and to being the kind of person who brings MGM back. I think there's no more iconic title card.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a great logo.
Nothing is cooler than having that lion in the front. Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know. I bet a lot of auteurs would love to have MGM. That title card in front of their movie.
It's got the prestige of being like one of those original big movie studios in Hollywood, right? Like that's the last one that's still around, right?
Well, I mean, Fox, you know, Fox has been around forever. Warner Brothers has been around forever. But
the 20s and that golden era.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Paramount is probably the only other one that so essentially you've got, you know, back in the heyday, you've got MGM, you've got Warner Brothers, you have Paramount, and then United Artists and Fox. Yeah. Those are kind of your big ones. I mean, what's interesting about, and it's everything that you're saying, Kenny, which is, you know, Sony keeps MGM afloat. It allows them to keep making stuff. You know, they try to reboot some of their older, they did a Ben-Hur reboot a few years ago, which did not do very well. But like, it's just interesting how they try to stay relevant in an industry that is shifting, obviously, very much towards franchises, very much towards, you know, IP and all that sort of stuff. And now it seems under DeLuca to try to kind of pivot towards something more in the Annapurna, you know, A24 vibe, which I think is interesting.
But I think Corinne's kind of point is interesting to me in terms of the idea that it's like kind of the last of these golden era studios. Like, it's not, because these movies have kept churning out these studios have kept churning out movies and TV. But what does Paramount mean to you? Very little. What does Warner Brothers mean to you? Very little. Yeah. What does Fox mean to you? Very little. What does MGM mean to you? Golden Age Hollywood. Judy Garland.
Yeah.
So the fact that MGM kind of went away for 20, 25 years has allowed it to take on this identity as we are the beating heart of golden era Hollywood. Now, I will also make another point. That means something today. That means something today in an era where the fucking Citizen Kane movie is being made by Netflix and movies are being made by Hulu and Amazon and Apple and have those cold logos, those cold corporate techno logos in front of those movies. To put something in, to put something out with MGM in front of it,
the real lion, the real roars. TriStar and the unicorn.
I was thinking like Columbia's been around forever too, but they mean nothing to people. That's a movie. But if you are sitting in a theater and the Three Lion Roars come on, and you have the smell of popcorn in your nose, you are actually transported in a way that the only thing that transports me that I love
and then
is when I watch a Universal movie from the 90s and they have that logo where it's like where you're take my money. I love it so much.
Yeah, I feel like it might be before Home Alone, something that I just watched 1,000 times and is just
the
like
the Fox movie.
Yeah. Okay. Well.
Yeah, the Fox fanfare is pretty great.
It's pretty great. Dun 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 dun. Fox fanfare is great. Warner Brothers as time goes by, right? That's pretty nice too.
And the Paramount with the stars.
The stars. I mean,
when you're tracking the stars, I'm down with it. I love tracking the stars. Yeah. I watched the Paramount movie last night.
Oh, really?
Major League, which we're doing on the Patreon very soon. Yeah.
That's great.
And you do they have the new like kind of CGI-ish one. It's beautiful.
It's funny because in Toronto, the like theme park is Paramount Canada's Wonderland. And they have the mountain. So for when I was growing up, I always thought that it was all those movies were the theme parks. Movies? I'm like, that's cool.
What attractions are at Paramount Canada Wonderland? Like, what are the Paramount?
The big central thing is like the Paramount Mountain, and a dude comes out a few times a day, jumps off it, and then there's like roller coasters.
We're not talking suicide.
It's like a diver kind of thing. He dives from the top of the mountain.
Jumps off it.
Four men commit suicide every day.
That is some Shelbyville shit right there, guys. Come on.
So here's a question for you guys. And this is some inside baseball, but whatever. What's your favorite lot? What's your favorite studio?
Paramount.
Yeah, Paramount.
It's got to be, right? Like, it's got to be. The fucking Paramount Gate.
I kind of like Sony. On Earth. I like Sony, too.
I also like Sony.
Sony's got fake grass.
Sony feels like, and I love Sony, and I love Artifice. Sony feels like it was created for me to feel like I'm in Hollywood.
Yeah,
whereas Paramount like just Disneyland. Feels like it was, which I love, and like much better than like some of the other ones in fucking Burbank. But there is just something about that Paramount lot and the fact that the auxiliary parking lot is where Moses parted the Red Sea. Hollywood is that?
They also have the Truman Show wall from the end of the movie when he hits his boat against the horizon.
Thing, right?
Is that the same thing?
Yeah,
same thing. Exactly. They used to use it for all the big like water sets.
Right. I take a picture of it every time. I have like 10 pictures of it because every time I go, I'm like, oh, I got to get this again.
Have
you ever parked in it?
No.
I've never parked in it either.
I always get so lost and confused when I have to park. I just do the first thing I can find.
I would argue that as much as I love the Paramount lot and I love the actual physical gate, like the Windsor Gate,
love it.
Is just the fucking best. Yeah. It's without a doubt the one I get lost at the most.
Yeah.
It's the one that I'm just like, wait, where is this? It's the most confusing, but it is the nicest, and I'm fine being confused there. So, can we just very briefly let's just talk about Nathan Lane in this movie?
Oh, there's so much to talk. We need a whole other hour to talk about Nathan Lane in this movie. By far, if you're gonna watch this movie, you watch it for Nathan Lane, and then you turn it off.
Well, I guess
two incredible scenes, one incredible smash cut.
Yeah, can you talk about the smash cut, Corinne?
What incredible Kangol hat.
Okay, so basically he plays this guy. He's like a professor of he's a professor who teaches children. He's,
I could tell you what his title is, if you bear with me for a second here. Because he what is his name? Okay, he is a physiotherapist, a visual physiotherapist.
Okay, so basically he teaches blind children how to be blind, kind of. Or like, isn't he teaching their parents how to be parents? It's something about like...
But in a Nathan Lane way.
He's teaching them Braille and things like that. He's a very nice person with a nice job. He calls himself a professor. Val Kilmer goes to him.
Yeah, calls himself a professor?
He says professor. And I'm like, that's cool.
Is he actually a professor?
I don't know. Maybe he was in a day.
He's a professor.
They go to see him and Val Kilmer's like, thank you for seeing us. You said you could help. And he's like, oh, I can't help you. Because he's having all these troubles, like he sees something, he doesn't know what it is, he has to touch it, so like I guess he's recommended to go there. And they sit down and they're all like, okay, so give us, you know, we think this is the point in the movie when like you have the montage of him like teaching him and like giving him tricks and stuff. He's like, no, can't help you, you're on your own.
So he's like I'm not Anne Bancroft.
No,
and we're like,
correct.
He said he's wearing these incredibly baggy chinos that are just like balloon parachute pants. He's got these little eyeglasses that are cat with little sparkles on the end.
He does.
Just comes out of fucking nowhere. You're like, this guy's the best part. He makes a bunch of jokes that don't fit with the tone of this movie. And then you're like, okay, he's like, goodbye, can't help you. And you're like, I guess that's the end of Nathan Lane. But then he comes back. He does
come back.
Because Val Kilmer comes back to him. I don't know why, because he's looking for guidance. And he's like, and then he sees him. And he's like, oh, hey, Val Kilmer. You know, let's give those eyes a rest. I know where we can go that's easy on the eyes. Cut to a titty bar. And they're just like watching ladies dance. You don't remember this? They're at this the children's school for the blind, and then it's a cut to a titty bar. So let's move.
I remember them drinking. I don't remember the alleged boobs.
They were.
I don't alleged.
They're just like we're just a couple of guys looking at boobs. Like,
I hope my wife is listening to this because I honestly have now, like, I don't even look. I don't even notice. It's over.
Well, here's the thing about Nathan Lane's performance in this film is that, I mean, I actually really love Nathan Lane. I think Nathan Lane's great. I really have no problems with Nathan Lane. In this movie, though, he's either being sat on, like he's being withheld from being Nathan Lane, right? Like he never really gets to go there. Which is why I sort of alluded when Corinne and I were texting. It feels a little bit like Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting, in the sense that he only kind of tips into Robin Williams-esque stuff a couple times, and even then it's pretty muted. This is a very muted Nathan Lane, and I just don't know why you cast Nathan Lane in this role.
And I feel like Nathan Lane didn't, because he's only in those two scenes, so he wasn't seeing all this stuff that's going on and all these terrible scenes and all this horrible acting, and he's just like, this is gonna be a fun movie, I'm just gonna like keep up with the pace of, like, what, and the director's like, yeah, do whatever you want. And I bet when Nathan Lane watched this movie, he's like, what film was
what on? Movie am I in?
It does reek of Nathan Lane and Erwin Winkler were like, one day we're gonna work together.
Yes
And you just put him in whatever role he had for him. The other thing is, though, like, I would take this over the guy you expect. Like, I think that's what you're saying more or less, right, Corinne? Like, the guy you expect in this role is basically fucking, you know, they've been doing this since Judd Hirsch in Ordinary People. The same old straight Jew, you know, this old straight fatherly New York-y, Brooklyn-y Jew.
Yeah.
Giving you kind of this tough love with like these like shitty jokes. And Rod Williams did his kind of like, you know, Gentile version of it, but it's the same character. Mm-hmm. Paul Giamatti has done it. We've had women versions of it, but like they're all the same, like old, like I've seen it all kind of bullshit. What I don't mind this version in terms of, you know, two scenes having to be a little different from the character I expect to see every fucking time someone walks into a therapist's
office. He's a bright spot, for sure. I just really want to know, is like, I guess it's this 90s idea of like what men did together is they went to titty bars. Like, is that... And honestly, I work with a lot of old school comedy writers who would probably say, but like, I just like just that harsh Nathan Lane, who I looked it up. I think he came out a month after this movie came out.
Yeah.
So it's just like this weird, like,
it's we also already crazy have to me that there was
female character, and now this is what we're doing in our spare time.
Yeah. It's weird. It's
funny.
It was good. Yeah, I enjoyed it, but it's terrible.
You know what's funny?
Yeah.
Probably one of the, if not the worst offender of this idea you're talking about, Corinne, is Entourage. Where, like, literally the boys, when we had nothing to do on, like, a Thursday.
Strip club.
Let's go to strip club.
I at least buy it from them.
Well, but that's a problem. That's what I'm getting at. That's a problem,
yeah.
Right? The problem is that we presented that reality for anybody. You know how many times in the 5 years I was there, the guys just got together and decided to go to a strip club? Zero times.
Once.
Okay. And if there's any group of guys you would expect to just like take off early from a day to work to go down to like fucking the Seventh Veil, you'd expect it to be the writers of Entourage, but that didn't happen because men don't do that.
I think they did. I think they did in the 90s, though.
No, I'm telling you, like, the only time I've ever done that as, like, not on a fucking fraternity rush event was my friends in college had a very sad tradition of doing it on Valentine's Day when we had no girlfriends. Yeah. And that is the end of it. I thought it was kind of cool, too, in its own weird way. But that is the end of it. That was the only time I've ever voluntarily done that.
I will say that, just for what it's worth, when I was in university in Toronto, I had a friend who we would go to like bars or go to clubs, not really clubs, but like
you
sort of,
went
I guess,
clubbing?
Not clubbing, but like dancing.
You remember dancing.
Oh, that's another thing I want to talk about in this movie.
Do you remember the Velvet Underground, Corinne?
Yes, of course.
Do you remember that in Toronto?
Yeah, that's like an alternative, cool music.
Okay.
Place.
Anyway.
Yeah.
That's my point. That's why, like, it's not a club, but it's a club, if you understand what I'm getting. Anyway, long story short, I would go out with this friend of mine, and then inevitably, he would get drunk, he would not hook up with anybody, and then he'd be like, can we just go to a strip club? And periodically, I would go with him. I'd say maybe twice I went with him. And it's very depressing. It's a depressing experience, especially when you're with a buddy who's just like, I didn't get laid tonight, so I'm gonna just do this. It's just sad. This is all speaking to what you're talking about, Kenny, which is that it feels like from a bygone time, like a time
maybe the 80s.
I'm not saying like this is like not valid either, but going at the end of the night when you're hammered as a weird little punctuation mark on your sad night is a lot different than going at like 6:30 when you're just bored.
In this movie, they go at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
When you're just looking for some shit to do.
Yeah.
It's like, that is some depraved shit. I'm sorry.
What does this person who can just see for the first time ever, what should I show him as a mentor to him? I ought to take him to a strip club.
Can I also ask a question? And I don't mean this to sound whatever, but are we supposed to believe that Nathan Lane is straight in this movie?
I guess.
Because I love Nathan Lane, but that's not really his vibe.
It would have been really funny if he would have been like, if they took him to the strip club and Val Kilmer's like, why would you take me here? And he's like, I don't know. I thought.
That actually would have been a better scene. That's a much better scene.
And they're like, God, we both don't want to be here. And then they like give the woman a very big tip and say,
perfect,
go back to school. And then they leave.
You wrote a better scene.
I mean, it's just.
Not, yeah.
That brings me to another point.
Please. Yeah.
How would this movie be different if someone had the balls to make it today?
Oh.
Because like I fear that maybe like 10 years ago when Johnny Knoxville, God love him, made The Ringer, which was just a questionable move, they went in this almost postmodern take. Yep. On disability, but you don't do that anymore. I just wonder, like, because there were little bits in this movie that I hated deeply that I think would be the whole movie in 2020. The little bits were all of the cited jokes Val Kilmer made throughout the movie.
Oh, like when he's like, what's that? And she's like, that's a homeless person. So that wasn't a joke, I guess.
man. No, that's what I meant. No, I mean like.
Oh, Corinne, that was great.
What I meant like when he says to her, "I didn't recognize you with your clothes on."
That was cute.
And then also, there's also this part, that same scene where she doesn't realize he's blind. Where, like, she talks to him for a long time, and he's, like, straight up walking with his hockey stick as a walking stick. Bus, yeah. Right outside the school bus. Meanwhile, like 20 minutes later, he meets a 10-year-old. The second thing the 10-year-old says to him is, like, are you blind? He's like, yeah. It's like, cool. Like, anybody would get this. But, yes, those little things I think would be the whole joke. I think they would all be jokes where the blind guy is like, you know, the joke he makes in the car where he's like, watch out, a car is coming.
You think that's what it would be if they made it today?
I think that's what it would. No, I actually don't think that's what it would be, because I think at some point someone would put the brakes on it. But I think that's what it would have been. That would have been in 2017.
I think they make it now with like a real blind person. They actually have somebody coordinate this, like talk to, like write it in a much better way with a much more nuanced approach.
It's but then
like,
how does that person see?
It's more like I think of like the diving bell and the butterfly, kind of that perspective of something just completely giving you a real perspective from kind of an eccentric means of filming or something like that. It's not a romance. It's just about this guy trying to like maybe move to New York. Maybe it's more of a peripheral relationship. It's really about his journey as this person. And we see it from his perspective.
I gotta tell you, like, I just don't know how you make this today. Like, I don't know how, and that's a good thing. Like, I don't know that this is a film that should be made.
You could do the diving bell and the butterfly version.
Yeah.
No question about that. You can't do a $60 million version. I don't mean that, though. That's my question. That's what I'm getting at. And I'm not trying to drive you guys to the answer if you can't do it. My question is, like, I do think there's always like a spot for someone like Julian Schnabel to make a movie where he act. I read Diving on the Butterfly and like literally unfilmable. It's unbelievable. He figured out anything to do with that. Mm-hmm. But I think there's always an example for someone to do, or an opportunity for someone to do a sensitive, smaller movie like that. But how do you get, how do you do this for, you know, $100 million? In a way that's commercial. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah. I don't know. What's the last movie that was kind of like an exploration of, you know, like.
I really have to say that, you know, I think that this industry has become far more sensitive to these type of stories, that they need to be told properly to a certain degree. I just think that, I think this would be a tough one.
This is what I'm getting at, though. And I know that I'm hazarding a little close to like the people who decry woke culture. That's not what I'm doing.
But what I'm saying is
I fear in this particular instance where in order to tell this story, you are going to necessarily need sighted people to help. Yeah. In more than just a technical producerial way, people won't tell these stories, and a story like this does need to be able to fail. It's like you make this and you fuck this up in 2020.
Yeah,
it's a career killer.
Yep.
But I still think like people should try. Like, for instance, Speechless, the show on ABC, made a show about someone differently abled, and it was very sensitive and very funny and very well done. And I think like everybody came out of that, you know, like smelling good.
And critically acclaimed too.
Yeah,
people liked it.
And based on an existing show that was already successful, so.
Yeah, it's true. And they cast, you know, a person with actual disabilities in the role. And I believe he had some autonomy and agency when it comes to, you know, the way he was portrayed. But that could have been a disaster.
Yeah.
And I do think we have to allow people to make these big mistakes. That's, I guess, I agree with that. I am very nervous about making that point because I do feel like that is hedging very close to the, like, you know, what I say on Twitter is just, you know, a joke, and what I say in the comedy club doesn't matter. Like, it does. And there's a way to get out that your intent is pure and you're not out here being a monster. It's tough. It's tough.
But I to your point, Kenny, I think that it's important that people can't be, and I put this in quotation marks, but like, people can't be afraid to tell these stories, right? Like, we need to be able to tell the breadth of stories and have the confidence to be able to try to do it. And sure, people might fail, but I think it's important that these stories are told. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that Speechless is a great show, and I think it's great that it existed and that it was able to give that actor the role to portray, to give that role, you know, to be able to put that out into the world. But I do think that this would be, I think this specific thing would be tough to do. It's tough to execute this, but I don't know.
I'm just remembering that the CW had, or could maybe continues to have, a show called In the Dark.
Yeah,
and
they do.
I loved that pilot. It was just about a woman who, she just happened to be blind, and she's solving kind of the mystery of her friend who's disappeared. And it's kind of like this woman who's just kind of a mess, and she's kind of messy. She's kind of like a flea bag type, and just kind of seeing her day to day. And they kind of, I felt like it really had a really nice balance of like a real perspective from that person. But also it's not, the story isn't about that. It's about all the other things she's doing at the same time.
It's great.
The lead actress is blind.
Interesting.
Actually, from this, I mean, I'm looking at it right
That's
now.
That's right. And it was based on a real person and her story. Huh. So it's kind of, yeah. That came out a couple of years ago. And I don't know. Is it still on?
It is still on. So I think what happened was they righted their ship, right? Like, yeah. Initially, I don't think they cast a blind person to play the role.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And I think they recast the role after there was some criticism, and I believe I believe that kind of worked out for them.
Right.
I haven't seen the show, unfortunately, but I do think that maybe this kind of undercuts my entire thesis.
I don't know. I actually haven't seen it. I've only watched the pilot. But it's a better version than this movie.
Should we rate this movie, Kenny?
Yes, we should rate this movie.
Okay, so you know how the rating system goes, Corinne, but I'll remind you just in case you don't. 0 to 99, 0 is the lowest, 99 is the highest. 50 is the general recommend, not recommend. You are the only one of the three of us that saw this in 99, so you will also give it a rating in 99.
Yeah.
I'll start. Didn't see this in 99. Before this podcast, I probably would have given it a 37. You know, I don't think that this film is an abomination. I think it's got some nice performances in it. It's got, you know, it's got a big heart. You know, I got suckered into it in the beginning anyway, in terms of like the romance.
To be fair, Phil, when you told me, you said, I think it says a lot about the pandemic and my emotional state right now, but I'm really enjoying this film.
Yeah,
let's not rule that out.
No. We shouldn't rule that out. And that's definitely like, when it started, I was like, oh, you know what? I could go for like a Hallmark type sweet romance about two, you know, two people just finding their ways to each other. Unfortunately, it's too long and it lost its hooks in me. But at the beginning, I thought it was quite sweet. I think it, you know, I think it's a nice movie, even if it's not a particularly good one. After the podcast, I mean, I think I'm probably at the same. I think maybe I might have gone up to 40 if I'm being generous, but I think I'm still probably in the mid 30s. But what about you, Corinne?
So when I saw it, I probably was at like 15. And all I remember was thinking like, that was long, wasn't what I wanted it to be. And something about cotton candy. Those are the things I took away. From it. The whole point of Val Kilmer remembers one thing from his like childhood, and it's a big puffy ball, and at the end of the movie he finds out it was cotton candy. So
yes, it's not the best reveal.
Yeah. So going into it, I was like, you know what, I'm an adult. I've seen other movies, maybe I'll like it. I think I went in or after I watched it again, I was like, maybe I'm at like a 25, because I was like, there's just more here. I can at least understand more of what they were trying to do than I could at 14 when I was just like, this love story sucks. After our conversation, I'm back down to 15. it's just not worth it. It's just not good.
Yeah.
I need to correct myself. The main actress in The Dark is not blind.
Oh.
Okay.
This is all research I'm doing on the spot, but I don't think they have any regulars who are actually blind.
Oh.
I really don't know much about this. I wouldn't mind if we'll cut this whole section out. But
all right, we can cut it.
Okay. This film, which stinks, I said this movie, all right, there's a lot. Like we didn't discuss the YMCA moment where he's at this party. We didn't even discuss Stephen Weber.
Yeah.
Like, I actually think it's very inspired that Erwin Winkler cast like the most, set the most horrifying scene in the movie to YMCA. That was very funny. Where Val Kilmer freaks out and walks through a play class window. I think this movie was truly, truly terrible. I gave it a 20. I said it was a joyless movie. Truly miserable. I think it's worse than that. I think it's worse. I think it's one of the worst movies we did. It doesn't anger me. It doesn't anger me as much as some of the other bad movies we did. I do think its heart is in the right place. I think 1999 was a particularly difficult time to deal with these type of subjects. You know, I do think that I'm happy they took their shot. Take your shot. Let's learn from it. I'm going to go down to an 18. It's a stinky, stinky movie. But, you know, whatever. We do every movie. That's it.
I'll also say
it's a stink fest.
It's a stink fest. And I forgot to mention that, like, I hate massages. Like, I hate them. So the idea... Like, a man silently touching me for an hour makes me incredibly uncomfortable. So the idea of falling, like, that initial premise, I forgot to say, was just completely...
It's a bad meet cute.
It's bad. It's like the thing you stay over a beer.
We spoke a lot about the way Mira Sorvino's character crossed the line. But it is crossing the line for a massage therapist to hit on his client in any way. That's a creep move.
It is a creep move, and she's so charmed by it. And it's just so like
should not be doing that.
Touching her, it's just awful.
Yeah, it's not good, guys. So next week, Kenny, you're going to be surprised by this, but next week I don't know if it's a surprise, but next week we're going to do an episode that I did by myself, so without Kenny.
Oh.
I know. Carrie Whitmer, a reporter for The Ringer and for Vulture, came on to talk about Frasier, an episode of Frasier.
Okay, Frasier.
The episode, in fact, where Woody from Cheer shows up.
My favorite.
Corinne, so there you go. I wanted to bring that up because I want to hear your thoughts, both of you, on Frasier. Fans, not fans? Were you a fan in 99?
Biggest fan then, the biggest fan now. I've already gone through it once during quarantine. I'm on round two, you know? It's just...
Are you serious?
I swear to God. It is.
You watched the entire run of Frasier?
I only go to the end of season... 7 because it gets real bad. But yeah, huge, huge fan. I think 99 was like
the 99 is season 6. So like it's getting
that's like the good, the meat of that series. Some of those jokes are just so fucking funny. I mean, I don't know about how well it's aged and all that, but just in terms of the comedy and the writing, it's so fucking good.
I watched an episode. I obviously watched the episode, the Woody episode, but I watched a bunch of episodes. And Kenny, I'm curious as to your thoughts on this because I feel like Frasier did farce, like full on, like almost radio play farce better than anyone else. Like that show, when it came to a whole bunch, when like the episode I watched the other day was an episode where one of Daphne's exes shows up and everyone has to basically pretend as though they're different people. Like Daphne is pretending to be married to Niles, and Ross is pretending to be married to Frasier, and the father Martin is playing an astronaut. Like everyone's just playing roles, and it's a style of comedy no one does anymore. And I you know, obviously, you know, you started in comedy, you know, comedy television. And I guess my question to you is sort of,
who, me?
Yeah, you.
Okay.
You know, that style of, is that ever anything you've wanted to do? Do you feel like you wish that there was more of that in TV now? I mean, how do you feel about that?
Great question. Love being the guest. The simple answer to your question is yes, but that is high level comedy. That is right. For actual, really strong comedy writers, okay. Which I am not. I absolutely love it when it's done on television, but I can't do it. My feeling on Frasier in general, is it kind of hit for me, and it sounds like you didn't watch a lot of it either, Phil. Growing up.
I mean, a handful of it, but not a ton.
So Frasier was on Tuesdays when Seinfeld and Friends were on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. And I was obviously a Seinfeld kid and also a Friends kid. Mm-hmm. And I think there was more overlap than people appreciated between those two camps.
Yeah, I was on board. I was all three.
Right. I think I was not erudite enough to appreciate Frasier. And I also was exactly like kind of that wrong age where like I would have probably had to watch it first run in order to get it. And it never struck me as something that I had to go back to the way I went back to Cheers, which I think is brilliant and perfect. So my guess is if I watch Frasier now, I would think it was fantastic. But I have almost no history with Friends. When Frasier got put in the Seinfeld slot, 9 o'clock on Thursdays was dead for me because Frasier felt like someone else's show. And then on top of it, it won the Emmy every year, which felt like someone was playing a joke on me and the shows I love. So, you know, that's basically how I feel about this.
So interesting.
But I do, from what I've seen, I do think, and I've seen probably seen 30 episodes of the show. I'm familiar with the characters and I'm familiar with their rhythms. From what I see, it does seem like about the highest level of, you know, situation comedy on a broadcast television you could possibly do.
Yeah. And it's just such a clean, clear, like it's a comedy of errors, and it's about a man who thinks he is a snob and the father who is not a snob and the clash of those two cultures and it's the brother versus the father. And it's, you can just mind that comedy for season upon season and it's still funny. It's still fresh. And because it's all grounded in the characters of who they are, you always laugh because you know, they're not just saying something funny. They're saying something funny and you know, it's because of who they are. It's people versus
the situation. It's funny you say that because the character thing is what hit me the most. And this ties into Seinfeld and Friends as well, Kenny, in the sense that like great sitcoms, the specificity of these characters is so bulletproof. That idea that you're like, I know how this person will react to this situation. And it's inherently funny just because of how well you know the characters. Like that's something that I guess Chuck Lorre is still sort of doing. I guess. I don't know because I don't really watch much of his stuff. But it feels like that's the last vestige of that sitcom thing. No? Okay. Kenny?
No. I mean, you're talking about multicam, but that's comedy. That is television comedy, what you just said. It's the anticipation of that joke. It's the anticipation of the way this actor would act. And we talked a little bit about this with Hunter on the Ghostbusters 2 episode, but you have a certain expectation lined up when a character's put in a position that they're going to act a certain way. The reason that what are the things people say over and over again?
Catchphrase.
The reason catchphrases work is because of that built-up anticipation in the release. When they say the right thing at the right time, you know what they're going to say, and it feels good for the audience. Then the reason why sometimes undercutting the catchphrase worked is because, oh, this is the kind of situation where this catchphrase wouldn't apply for this particular character. And that's interesting too, and also funny that we've learned this new wrinkle about that character. So I think like what you were talking about specifically probably applies to Big Bang. I mean, I've seen enough of Big Bang to know that like Jim Parsons' character is a pretty, you know, classic sitcom creation.
Yeah.
But it also
Bazinga.
Sure. It also applies.
That's his catchphrase.
I'm not talking about the catchphrases. I'm just saying catchphrases kind of like rudimentary way of explaining this. But it also applies to like high level shit. It applies to Atlanta. It applies to Dave. It applies to all this. You know, it applies to Girls. It applies to Fleabag. It applies to everything that like that you know, because comedy is really just about rhythms, anticipation, structure, expectations, undercut expectations, or follow through in terms of like the joke telling. I think the joke telling, you know, is like tedious and hard. So
you're not wrong.
That's why he's a drama writer now.
I just take out the hardest part, and I'm not kidding. Like you take out the hardest part and amp up the part that like I actually like writing. And then you don't have the accent. And if anything's funny, it's like you found a little, you know, a little bonus, a little extra piece of candy at the bottom of your bag.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I do think there's an irony in the fact that I'm writing a comedy now. And
I just, but it's funny because for me, I always think of the joke first and then I work my way back to the story of like, how do we make that joke feel real?
Yeah. Yep.
And make a story around it as opposed to just kind of randomly saying something that's really funny.
Or
that's so much easier for me. I just,
Corinne, thank you so much for coming
on.
Thank
you so much for having me.
We look forward to having you back in the future.
Whenever you want.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. Podcast like it's
1999. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.